So we have Professor Brian Clough, University of Lancaster, who his area of expertise, one of his areas of expertise, and on which he's written widely, is the Mahabharata. So it's great. He's just the man for the job for this session and the session after lunch. And without further ado, I'll leave you with Professor Brian.
Well, thank you very much. I just want to say what a pleasure it is to be here. This is my, I've done one event at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, but that was actually so long ago, I don't even remember what year it was. I think it was in 2004 or 2005. So it's been a long time since I've been here, and it's a pleasure to be back. My name is Brian Black. I'm a lecturer at Lancaster University. I've been there for about 7 years now. Before that, I did my MA and PhD in a 3-year postdoc at SOAS. So despite my accent, which I haven't lost yet, I've lived in this country now for 21 years. And it's a pleasure to be here today to talk about the Mahabharata. Most of my academic work has either been on the Upanishads or the Mahabharata, as well as the Bhagavad Gita. Right now, I'm working on a 3-year research project on the Mahabharata. So both of the talks that I'm giving today are going to be very much based on the research that I'm developing as part of this project. Another thing that I'm just going to mention at the outset, just because I think that some of you might be interested in this, and I would love to hear any of your thoughts or contributions, maybe during lunch or during any of the breaks, is that part of my research project is an outreach project. And you know, these days you can't get money to do research unless you try to convince the authorities that you're saving the world or something like that. So my outreach project is to use the Mahabharata as a way for GCSE, AS, and A-level students who are already studying about Hinduism to learn more about Hinduism. So basically what I'm going to do as part of this project is put together a number of exercises and resources for British students who happen to be studying Hinduism, and whether or not they're studying Hinduism has very little to do with their background and a lot of, you know, where their school happens to be, the teacher's background, the teacher's interest, etc. And I think that you'll see from some of the slides I've made here that I've already sort of developing these slides with that aim in mind. So anyway, I'm not going to be talking about that during the talk, but if any of you have your own sort of links with schools or have your own ideas about these sorts of things, I'd love to hear them throughout the day. So I'd like to just start by praising Jessica for her wonderful introduction. Not only did I think it was a great way to start off these 3 days, but I think it was a perfectly great way to introduce me, even though she had no idea what I was going to talk about. There are a number of things that she focused on that I think are very much going to be at the center of what I'm talking about. She talked about the diversity of Hinduism, the plurality of Hinduism, but she also used a word a lot that's really one of my favorite words as a scholar, one of the words that some of my colleagues think I'm obsessed with as a scholar, and the word that's in the name of both of my talks, and that is the word dialogue. So my approach to the Mahabharata is going to be very much looking at the Mahabharata as a conversation and what it means to look at the Mahabharata as a conversation. So I thought it was absolutely perfect that that has already been set up in that way. So, now, luckily, I'm speaking to an audience that that probably, at the very least, have some familiarity with the Mahabharata. You probably know the main story. If there's anything, any details that I say along the way that you know that you don't, you want a little bit more background for, I'm happy to sort of stop and explain. But I'll just say a few things that I would normally say to any audience that I'm introducing the Mahabharata to for the first time. These are dates that are suggested by scholars, and that is that the Mahabharata was probably composed somewhere between 400 BC and 400 in the Common Era. The Mahabharata is probably one of the most difficult texts in the world to put a date on. Most scholars would think that it was probably a text that was composed over a long period of time. In other words, it wasn't composed by one author, it wasn't composed in a few years, but a text that had maybe a sort of core that was added to and then added to and added to again. It is worth noting, though, that there are some scholars working on the Mahabharata today who disagree with this paradigm of the composition of how it was composed, and instead think that actually it probably was composed in a much shorter period of time, of course using material that was quite old, but the final composition of it was actually in a shorter period of time by a much smaller group of people who had some sort of larger idea of the unity of the text. Now, I'm not here to try to solve these debates or to really weigh up in on them too much, but it's good to know that there are different theories about the compositional history of the text. It is the longest poem in the world, and as Jessica already gestured towards its length, it is really about this long on your bookshelf. My kids can't believe how much space the Mahabharata takes up in my office, not to mention all the various different translations and commentaries and books about the Mahabharata. And the characteristics of the text that I want to focus on are its complexity, its diversity, but also its multi-vocality. And what I mean by that is there are many voices in the Mahabharata. And a lot of understanding the Mahabharata is listening to not what we might think is always the main voice, but the different voices that are represented in the text. And it's also important, I see, maybe this is getting a bit controversial, but I see the Mahabharata as really being one of the first identifiably Hindu texts. I mean, of course, the Hindu tradition looks back and thinks of the Vedas and the Upanishads as being Hindu, and they are in retrospect. But what we know of as Hinduism today was still just forming during the period that those texts were composed. And if you take some of the main ideas of Hinduism now, you're not going to find a lot of them, especially in the Rig Veda or the Brahmanas. You'll see some of them in the Upanishad. But the Mahabharata is a text that really has some of the main ideas of Hinduism that are still present in a lot of Hinduism today. Although I think every time I say something like that, we should remember what Jessica was pointing out, that we probably should be thinking about Hinduism and the diversity of traditions there. But some of the core ideas, dharma, moksha, bhakti, yoga, caste, they're all there in the Mahabharata. So I think it's a wonderful text to read to get a better understanding of the Hindu tradition. And that's part of the reason why I think it would be a wonderful way for kids growing up in Britain who are learning about Hinduism as a place to start, because it has so many of these quintessentially Hindu ideas. Okay, so a few things generally about what it's about. Again, you probably know this. Maha meaning great. Bharata is in the Mahabharata the name of a family, but it's also the name of India, in the sense that, as I'm sure all of you know, that one of the ways to refer to India now is Bharat, and that's the same word that that we find all the way back in the Mahabharata. So it's a history of a people. It's a history of it's basically taking it's a link between a sort of history of a people and putting that in the context of a cosmic history. There are also a number of themes that are very important in the Mahabharata. Again, it's never just about one thing. If we're looking at the plot, we might think that one of the main events of the plot is this rivalry about who is the rightful heir to the throne. We have the Pandavas, we have the Kauravas, and we have a debate over who should be the next king. So, of course, one dimension of the Mahabharata is this really sort of down-to-earth political drama of basically who will secure the authority to rule a particular territory. It's a civil war. And one of the things that I've been actually exploring recently is that how there are interesting parallels between the story of the Mahabharata and some of the histories in my own country looking back at America's Civil War. The Mahabharata and a lot of histories of the American Civil War explore some very similar themes. And I think that's yet one more example of how some of the themes that the Mahabharata explores are quite universal themes that have been explored by a number of different cultures in different historical circumstances. But it's not just about people, it's not just about this war, it's not just about the conflict over this throne. We see that the Mahabharata is always connecting itself to a sort of cosmic history. So we see that it's also a battle between gods and demons, a battle between good and evil. So there are these, large cosmological themes that are explored throughout the text. But one of the things that I want to focus on is the Mahabharata as an inquiry into Dharma and ethics. Because despite the fact that it's this long, wonderful narrative story, and that it's also so engaging and in a sense, despite its length, quite accessible, because of this story that appeals to people across time and culture, it's also a deeply philosophical text. Some people, for example, say that the Mahabharata's length can be compared to the length of the Iliad and the Odyssey, and it's often this figure that the Mahabharata is 8 times longer than the Iliad and the Odyssey combined, is often a statistic that's kind of rolled out when describing its length. And I do think that does give you a sense of how long it is, but I would see the Mahabharata as not only compared to the Iliad and Odyssey in length, but in content. The Mahabharata would be, if you threw the Iliad and the Odyssey and all of Plato's dialogues all together into one text. So it has this main story, this story that's about a war, that has a lot of action in it, but it also is very philosophical. From start to finish, it's reflecting on some, especially moral problems. And this is the angle that I want to take on the Mahabharata today. I'm hoping that looking at these aspects of the Mahabharata will, no matter what background of understanding of the Mahabharata you bring to today's lectures, I hope that this will, in one way or another, expand your thinking and expand your appreciation of this wonderful text. I certainly agree with my own readings of the text, but not for one moment would I try to present them as the only way to read the text. The Mahabharata is far too complicated, diverse, multivocal, for it to be reduced to what I'm going to say is a good approach. But nonetheless, I still think that this is an approach that's very worth taking about the Mahabharata, and I hope that you enjoy taking this approach with me, at least today. Okay. So I'll just say a few more general things. I wasn't exactly sure who was going to be here today. This is a slide, basically kind of telling you about how much the Mahabharata is still relevant today.
not only, it's not just this ancient text in Sanskrit, but it's also very much part of Indian culture today, both in India, but also throughout the world. One of the things I'm particularly excited about, just last week, I had a conversation with this young man named Taj from Bradford, who's putting together a theater production of the Mahabharata to take place in Bradford, hopefully in the years to come. So this is a story that's still being interpreted, still being performed, as much today as probably as it ever was. I also just have a list of some fun ways to learn about it. No matter how much you already know about the Mahabharata, you can always learn more. And here are some fun ways. There's obviously the Hindi television series, both the old one and the newer version that I think is still going on right now. Both of them are available for free on YouTube. I know the old one, you have English subtitles as well. Peter Brook's Mahabharata is also available for free online on YouTube, so you can watch that in its entirety as well. As I'm sure all of you are familiar with, the Mahabharata is presented in comic book form. That's a wonderful way to learn about it as well. There's also a podcast of the whole story in 100 episodes, put together coincidentally by one of my best friends, even though he's one of the weirdest people I know, in California. He does a very good job with the story. I'm not going to say I agree with everything that he says along the way, but it's another good way to learn about the text. Just to complicate my life, I said I'm a lecturer in Lancaster. I actually live in Durham, which is, you know, two sides of the country, even more. So I do a lot of driving. So I love podcasts and public lectures and things like that. So I don't know if any of you do, probably not as much traveling as I do, but if you do have long car or train journeys, that's a wonderful thing to do to pass that time. You'll probably want the train journey to be a bit longer if you're listening to that podcast. Okay, but now I want to start to introduce to you my kind of what I'm setting up is our lens of looking at the Mahabharata today, and this is the lens of dialogue. And I choose to look at the Mahabharata through dialogue for a number of reasons. I mean, I can't help but say one of the reasons is because I'm interested in dialogue, and when I did my work on the Upanishads, I was focusing on the dialogical aspect of the Upanishads as well. So it's perhaps not surprising for anybody who knows me that here I go again, I'm using the lens of dialogue. But I feel that the Mahabharata actually invites me to do so as well. It's not just me trying to push dialogue onto the text, but the Mahabharata, I would argue, is not only a particularly dialogical text, but I would say that, as far as I know, it's the most dialogical text I've ever encountered. What do I mean by that? Well, first of all, let's start with the frame stories of the Mahabharata. Now, not everybody who grew up with the Mahabharata in terms of hearing stories within your family or listening, you know, watching the TV versions or reading the comic book, you might not get this part of the text that exists in almost every manuscript tradition that I know of. And that is that the Mahabharata doesn't start with the story about the Pandavas and Kauravas. Instead, it starts with a story of a dialogue, of a conversation. And in this initial conversation, we have two main interlocutors. One, we have this guy by the name of Ugrasravas. And Ugrasravas is basically a bard. He's a traveling storyteller. He's a professional storyteller. And he shows up in the forest, in the Naimisha forest, which is a sort of magical place where a lot of Brahmins hang out and perform rituals and listen to stories. He shows up and he encounters a group of rishis, and the leader of these rishis, his name is, and that's one of the reasons why I love the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies so much, his name is Shanaka. So, I mean, I love the fact that I'm working with somebody named Shanaka. So Ugrashravas shows up to Shanaka and basically says, you know, I'm a professional storyteller. What do you want to hear? And Shanaka and the Rishi says, well, I want to hear the story of the Mahabharata. But Ugrashravas doesn't say, okay, well, great. Let me introduce you to the Pandavas and the Kauravas. Because Shanaka doesn't quite say it that way. He says, I want to hear the story of the Mahabharata. Then he says, you know that story that was told by this other guy named Vaishampayana to this other guy by the name of Janamejaya during a snake sacrifice that he was performing. So the Mahabharata starts out with these two dialogues. On the one hand, we have this professional storyteller telling these Brahmins, these Brahmin rishis in the forest about a story that was told by this Brahmin by the name of Vaishampayana and, you know, to this king by the name of Janamejaya. Another important detail here is Janamejaya is Arjuna's great-grandson. So there's a link in that dialogue between the people who are hearing the story and the people in the story itself. So, now, I could actually spend pretty much all day just talking about those two dialogues themselves. They're so interesting. There's so many quirky, mysterious details in them, all of which I think indicate different things about the Mahabharata itself. But the only thing I want to emphasize here, that it's not for nothing that I've decided to use dialogue as a lens to look at the Mahabharata. Because the Mahabharata itself sets up dialogue as a lens to look at itself. And back to the things that Jessica was talking about, any time that we're looking at a text, I think it's always important to look at who's speaking and who's listening. Or if she says, who are the authors? Who is the audience? And so, as I said, you know, we could actually spend the rest of the day just looking at the implications of these conversations. We're not going to do that. But I think already we can see that dialogue is a very important lens through which to be looking at the Mahabharata. Another reason, however, equally important as why dialogue is a very important way to be looking at the Mahabharata, is that so many of the key episodes in the Mahabharata itself are, except for the war books, of course, that's a third of the entire text, so that's a huge exception to make. But in most of the other books, the key action is actually people talking to each other. So the Mahabharata will often very quickly sort of tell the tale of how this person fought this person, how this person married this person, etc. But so many of the key events in the story are actually conversations. They're actually dialogues where the main characters are discussing with one another, oftentimes arguing with one another, about what the right thing to do is within a particular situation. So in that sense, not only do we have the story framed by dialogue, but we have dialogues as some of the main events in the story. Now I'm going to talk about which of these dialogues I'm going to concentrate on in a moment. But one thing, you know, what's probably the most famous episode in the entire Mahabharata? Bhagavad Gita. What's that? It's a dialogue. It's a conversation. So already I think you can see what I'm getting at here. Then another kind of level of dialogue within the Mahabharata is that oftentimes when characters in the story are talking to one another, what do they talk about? They talk about other dialogues. So many of the, in kind of the stories that are nested within the main story are also dialogues themselves. And one of the things that I'm going to argue is that there is often then, I mean, just to kind of take this metaphor further, a dialogical relationship between the stories that embedded in the main story and the dialogues in the main story. So in other words, not only are there a lot of dialogues, but one of the things that I'm exploring here today is that these dialogues are actually talking to each other. That these dialogues are reflecting upon each other, giving, reflecting upon each other, commenting on each other. And what I'm going to do is demonstrate that by looking at a number of examples. Okay, so one of the things that I want to focus on are not just any dialogues, but the dialogues that explore moral questions. Now, there are a number of moral questions in the Mahabharata. And back to that earlier slide when I was talking about what the Mahabharata is about, in my opinion, from my interpretation, is that that's one of the fundamental things about the text, is to explore these questions. And so I would argue that these are some of the main scenes in the text where you have a problem being posed, and then that problem is explored through dialogue and debate. The ones in bold are the examples that I'm going to focus on this morning. So we're going to look at Bhishma's vow. We're going to look at Draupadi's marriage. And then we're going to look at Arjuna's hesitation before the war, or in other words, the Bhagavad Gita. Now, this afternoon, when I talk about women in dialogue, I know it's titled Gender in Dialogue, but I'm actually going to focus much more on women in dialogue. We're going to explore women in dialogue through Draupadi's question. So we're actually going to be looking at most of these episodes that I'm saying are some of the key moments in the story that moral questions are posed and then explored through dialogue. Now, B.K. Motilal, who, in my opinion, is one of the greatest scholars of the Mahabharata, precisely because he explored the Mahabharata more philosophically than a lot of other interpreters of the text, he saw these episodes, or at least some of these episodes, as moral dilemmas. As he puts it, they are situations in which a choice must be made between two or more courses of action, where there is no clear answer to which course of action is more correct, and where the situation remains, in some sense, unresolved. According to Motilal, most moral dilemmas are indeed unresolvable. Now, I'm going to basically be following Motilal's reading here. These are really the points that I'm going to be making, is that in all of these situations, we get at least two, sometimes multiple explanations of how to explore this moral question, and that none of these moral questions ever go away. They're never completely answered. And to me, from my reading of the Mahabharata, that's what makes the Mahabharata so interesting and so profound, that it's not telling you the answer. That so much of what the Mahabharata is doing is that quote that Jessica showed you from the Bhagavad Gita. It's presenting you with all these questions, but it's ultimately up to you to solve things for yourself. The only caveat that I would have here, though, is that And this is something, I don't know, I mean, maybe you can help me with. I'm still struggling with the term moral dilemma, because I don't know if that completely works for these situations. And the reason I'm not sure about that is a dilemma always involves a choice. And I'm not sure if every one of these situations really necessarily implies there's an agency for the person involved in the situation itself. I think in a lot of these cases, the dilemma is more for us as readers. So in other words, the question, that's why I'm more comfortable with moral question, because I think the Mahabharata itself, as a text, as a dialogical text, the way it's composed, it's certainly showing us that there are multiple potential paths that could have been made. But it's not always necessarily saying that that person, Yudhishthira, that person, Arjuna, could have done something differently. But we as readers might question whether we would have done the same thing. So that's why I'm saying there's a slight difference between how I'm seeing a moral question, which I think the Mahabharata very much is posing moral question, and moral dilemma, because that might imply too much that that there's a sort of free agency for every character. Whereas I think that's actually part of the moral question, is that does that character have agency or not? Okay. So, let's start with Bhishma's vow. Now, in many ways, this really sets off the events that end up leading to the Mahabharata war. We're going to assume that most of you know that that there's this huge war in the Mahabharata, and that there's a really sort of tragic element to this story. That so much about the Mahabharata is exploring the pain and suffering and the tragedy of having to fight that war and the consequences of that war. And so I think it's important to see that in many ways, Bhishma's vow is the beginning of a chain of events that end up leading to that war. So I'm sure you've all heard of Bhishma, but let me just set the scene here a little bit, and maybe there's some details that some of you have forgotten. So Bhishma is the king of King Shantanu, and his mother is the river goddess Ganga. His father is King Shantanu. And basically, when we're first introduced to the fact that Bhishma, once he's sort of grown up and he starts living with his father in the kingdom, things look pretty good. We have this king, Shantanu, and we already have this crown prince, Bhishma, who, is everybody assumes is going to take the throne, and nobody doubts his abilities to be able to do so. So we have a perfectly good situation for handing over royal authority. Except, then his dad wanders off and falls in love with the daughter of a fisher king. And basically, he wants to marry her. This woman's name is Satyavati. And basically, King Shantanu asks for her hand in marriage from her father. And Satyavati's father says, well, maybe, but you can only marry my daughter if any children that you have would basically be the heirs to the throne. But the thing is that the Fisher King's also a little bit concerned about any rivals from any offspring that Bhishma might have. So King Shantanu realizes right away that he's in an impossible situation. He's completely head over heels in love with Satyavati, but he realizes that he won't be able to marry her because he simply won't be able to satisfy the conditions of Satyavati's father. So he goes back to the palace and he's completely despondent. And Bhishma finds him in that situation. Now, so Bhishma finds him completely despondent. He asks his dad what's bothering him. But very interestingly, his dad lies to him. His dad is not truthful about what's really bothering him. All of a sudden, he starts talking about, like, well, he's concerned about the legacy of the family because, well, he only has one son, and what if something were to happen to him? But that's not why he's upset. He's upset because of this separation from Satyavati. I think that's important because I think we need to reflect on, was this really a good idea for Bhishma to do what he ends up doing? Shantanu, he's lusting after Satyavati, but he tells Bhishma that he merely wants to protect the lineage. And so Bhishma then makes this extraordinary vow. He goes to Satyavati's father, and he basically asks for Satyavati's hand in marriage on behalf of his father, and says that in order to make sure that that there's no rivalry coming from any offspring of his own, that he takes this vow of celibacy. And so this is this famous vow that Bhishma makes that kind of sets off these events that ultimately lead to the war. But one of the things that I find particularly interesting, then, I'm putting this as a sort of moral question, because the question of whether, if you make a vow, first of all, under what conditions should you make a vow in the first place? When is it good to make a vow? When is it not good to make a vow? But also the questions of whether you should always keep your vow, no matter what. Even if the circumstances change under which you made your vow in the first place, these are questions that the Mahabharata will continue to take up for the rest of the story. And so one of the things that I want to show here is that there's some dialogues where this question is taken on directly, but then there are other episodes where this question is taken on more indirectly, but still, in one way or another, end up reflecting back on this situation. Okay. I thought I would just pause for a moment here and go over this family tree, just so you have a sense of where we are in the story. So, what I've been basically talking about so far is Shantanu, King Shantanu, who, with the river goddess Ganga, has a son named Bhishma. But then Shantanu does end up marrying Satyavati, and they have these two children together, Chitrangada and Vichitravirya. And these two sons are now lined up to be the heirs to the throne. The first one, I think, dies as a child, and the second one dies in battle. So, here we are with King Shantanu in the first place. Remember, he thought that one son wasn't enough? He was saying that he was worried about that. Well, then he gets two more, and neither one of them live long enough to take over the throne. So basically, a generation later, we're in a worse situation than we were in the first place. In the first place, we're in a great situation. We had this excellent crown prince. Now we're in a situation where the initial crown prince has taken a vow of celibacy and declared not to take over the throne, and now we have no heirs.
that's when Satyavati calls in her son Vyasa, who you probably all know of as the author of the Mahabharata itself. Again, another wonderfully complex aspect of the Mahabharata is the author is within the story itself. So Vyasa ends up basically mating with these two queens, Ambika and Ambalika. And through these unions, we get the kings Dhritarashtra and Pandu, and these are the fathers of the Kauravas and the Pandavas. Dhritarashtra's the blind king who ends up marrying Gandhari, and they have 100 sons, the Kauravas, the oldest of which is Duryodhana. And then Ambalika's son is Pandu, who ends up marrying Kunti and Madri. And Pandu's sons with Kunti are Yudhishthira, Bhima, and Arjuna, and with Madri here in Nakula and Sahadeva. I'm hoping that at least this is all ringing bells for most of you. I'm sure that you've heard these names, but I thought it would be helpful at one time just to sort of, you know, see how it all works. But I'm going to move swiftly on from there, because I want to start looking now at how Bhishma's vow is challenged. Okay, so here we are, this second, you know, this generation later. Basically, the two crown princes now have died. Now the original conditions under which Bhishma had made this vow are no longer there. So, Satyavati, the very kind of reason why Bhishma made the vow in the first place, now goes to Bhishma to plead with him to give up, for him to give up his vow. Now it's interesting that technically, even though, you know, we're not really sure the age difference between them, technically Satyavati is Bhishma's stepmother. So as his stepmother, she's approaching Bhishma and she's basically appealing to Dharma. It's interesting here that Bhishma actually calls Satyavati mother during the scene. He addresses her as mother. And when we get to our next moral question, you might see an interesting sort of contradiction here, because he ends up disobeying his mother. And he actually renews his vow. She invokes a particular type of dharma called apadharma, which basically, you know, we might say is a more sort of pragmatic approach to dharma, that, you know, that universal rules don't, you know, there are no universal rules that apply to all times and all circumstances. A lot of dharma is sort of figuring out things as you go along. And she's saying this should be one of these cases. Yeah, you made this vow for good reason in that circumstance. Things have changed. Now I'm going to ask you to do something different. Also, interestingly, one of the ways in which she frames his choice is between action and inaction. Because basically she's saying that by keeping his vow, he's not acting. Where he should act, he should get involved, and he should help the situation. This is exactly the sort of argument that Krishna makes in the Bhagavad Gita. I mean, again, it's not the only argument he makes, but much of his argument is framing things in terms of action versus inaction. Okay, so this is what I'm saying is our first challenge to Bhishma's vow, that we actually have a dialogue between Bhishma and Satyavati, where she argues with him about why he should give up his vow. Okay. But then, another challenge, where that's a direct challenge, I'm presenting this as an indirect challenge, and this is between Krishna and Arjuna. Now, this isn't the Bhagavad Gita. Not yet, anyway. I'm going to say a little bit about the Bhagavad Gita in a moment. But the Bhagavad Gita isn't the only moment in the text where Krishna and Arjuna have a dialogue with one another. And it's not even the only part of the text where they have a dialogue with one another about dharmic and philosophical things. So this is actually, this appears in one of the battle books. This is actually during the war as it's going on. And in this scene, basically, Arjuna has returned from the battlefield early that day, and Krishna basically, Yudhishthira, his older brother, says to him, what are you doing back here already? You should be out there fighting alongside your brothers. It's tense. There's a war going on. Passions rise. And the next thing we know, Yudhishthira is saying, you're a coward. Our mother should have aborted you before you were even born. That's how much of a coward you are. Well, Arjuna, and then, to make matters worse, he even offends his famous bow, the Gandiva bow, that is a special weapon for Arjuna. Arjuna is so offended, but one of the things is we learn at this moment that Arjuna had actually taken a vow several years beforehand that he would kill anyone who offended his bow. And so here we are in the middle of this battle, that this whole book has been leading up to, and the two of the most important brothers of the Pandavas are at odds with one another. And basically Arjuna has decided that in order to keep his vow, the only thing that he can do is kill Yudhishthira at this moment. Well, imagine how horribly wrong things would have gone if that happened. So who steps in at this point? Krishna. Krishna's like, what are you talking about? This is ridiculous. You can't go around doing things like that. Now, we're actually going to revisit what Krishna says to Arjuna actually later on in this talk, because I think that this scene is also in dialogue with the Bhagavad Gita. But one of the things that Krishna tells Arjuna at this point is he tells him this story. So many teachings are about telling a story or about reciting a dialogue that took place, before him. And in this story, he talks about this sage by the name of Kaushika. And Kaushika was known for always speaking the truth. And Kaushika had taken this vow that he was always going to speak the truth and always going to keep his vow. So in a sense, there's like two virtues here. One is he's taking a vow and sticking with it. But then secondly, that the vow is truth itself. So anyway, Kaushika takes his vow that he's always going to tell the truth. And then he's off meditating in the forest one day. And he notices like a whole family run by him. A whole family that's just terrified. They're running for their lives. And, he's kind of meditating at a crossroads. There's one path this way and one path that way. And he sees the entire family run off that way. And then 5 minutes later, these evil bandits come up. And they ask Kaushika, hey, where did that family go? And Kaushika has vowed to always tell the truth. So what does he do? Well, he tells those bandits exactly where the family went. And he ends up going to hell for this. Krishna's point here is that it's ridiculous to think that it's always good to tell the truth. And in fact, it's ridiculous to think that you must always keep your vow. There must be some circumstances under which it's not a good thing to tell the truth. There must be some circumstances under which it's not always good to keep your vow. And so I think one of the things going on here, again, is looking at the relationship between these scenes, is that we know what Bhishma ends up doing. But one of the things I'm arguing here is that decision never goes away. We're not, that problem is never solved. We're introduced to other moments in the text where we're still reflecting back on that moment, sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly. Okay, now I want to introduce you to our next moral problem. And this involves Draupadi. Draupadi, who we'll be talking about quite a bit more this afternoon. Just a few things about Draupadi. She's born from the fire. She's an incarnation of Shri. But also that she's married to all five Pandava brothers. You probably already know that. Now, I think to modern audiences, that just seems a bit strange. How can one woman be married to five men at the same time? But one of the things I think is very interesting is that the Mahabharata seems to struggle with that as well. There are a number of different scenes within the Mahabharata and characters within the Mahabharata that are never completely happy with that arrangement. And so again, this is presented as a problem with different interpretations, different ways of understanding it. And one of the things I want to suggest here is that the different explanations that are given for Draupadi's marriage actually tell us about the plurality of the Mahabharata itself, because some of these explanations tap into different worldviews, all within Hinduism, but worldviews that don't completely sit comfortably with one another. Okay. So, basically, what are some of the explanations for how Draupadi can be married to five men at the same time? Well, the first explanation we get is actually given by Vyasa himself. Vyasa obviously is a voice of authority, but back to my earlier point, he's not the voice of authority. I would argue there are many voices of authority. Vyasa is certainly one of them. Now, and Vyasa ends up giving a lot of these explanations. So, he authorizes a number of different interpretations here. But the first explanation we get is even before this marriage ever happens, and Vyasa is visiting the Pandavas and telling them that there's going to be this wedding ceremony, this wedding contest, this triumvirate, where Draupadi is going to be able to, choose her husband, or actually be given the husband who ends up winning this archery contest. So this is the first scene in the Mahabharata where the Pandavas hear about Draupadi, and Vyasa then basically gives them a sort of indication of their destiny by telling them this story that took place in a past life, a story about a sage's daughter who had asked Shiva five times for a husband. And as a consequence, Shiva gives her five husbands for her next birth. And then Vyasa reveals that this young woman was Draupadi in a previous life. So if we wanted to attach a word or a sort of cosmological interpretation to this explanation, I think we could easily say that this explanation is about karma. This explanation is basically saying that things that have taken place in previous lives are affecting things that are happening in this life. And so the explanation for why Draupadi can marry five men at the same time is because of karma, because of something Draupadi herself did in a past life. Okay. But we also get another explanation. This is one of the most famous explanations. If you've heard any explanation, my guess it would be most likely to be this one. And that is that after the Pandavas go to the Swayamvara, after Arjuna wins the archery contest and is basically announced as Draupadi's husband, then all the five Pandavas together return to their mother. And as they're approaching the kitchen, they sort of call out, "Hey, Mom, guess what we have?" And their mother, Kunti, having no inkling at all what they have with them, says, "Well, whatever it is, share it among you." And then becomes horrified to learn that what they have is Draupadi. Now, what's interesting is that this is given as an explanation for why they should marry Draupadi. I mean, first of all, it's weird that just because their mother said something that she had no idea what the context was, and we all know that most young men go against their mother's words, like, a lot. It seems surprising that this is particularly binding. But it's also interesting if we compare it to Bhishma's moral question, that, okay, Satyavati is his stepmom, not his real mom, but still, he treats her like a mother. Why is Bhishma allowed to go against the words of his mother when his mother actually knows exactly what's going on and gives very good arguments for why he should do what he does? Where here, the Pandavas are told they should just obey their mother completely blindly, even though she was talking about something completely different. But I think that if we're looking for a word to kind of understand the logic here, we might say that this is an explanation that's given in terms of Dharma, one's duty to one's mother. And, you know, I'm not saying Dharma is completely different from karma. You know, there are all sorts of ways in which they're related. But we could say that this is a different type of explanation going on here to understand why Draupadi is allowed to marry five men. Okay. Then, you know, one of the great things, again, this whole situation generates a lot of dialogue. Draupadi's married practically in an instant, but there's a lot of waffling about it later, a lot of analyzing it and discussing it and questioning it. And, of course, we get one of our great wafflers in the Mahabharata, Yudhishthira, who is, again, trying to make sense of this situation. And one of the ways, not the only way, but one of the ways that he makes sense of this situation is by talking about the subtleties of Dharma. So here's a very interesting argument that, being an American born in 1970, I still think of as the Richard Nixon defense, and that is, he says, "My voice does not tell a lie, nor does my mind dwell on lawlessness. As my thoughts ferret, it cannot be a breach of the law." So in other words, Yudhishthira has convinced himself that, you know, remember, his divine father is Dharma. If I think it and I say it, because I'm just so dharmic, it must be okay. I mean, I think of Richard Nixon because he says, you know, "I was the president. The president does not commit crimes. If I did it as the president, it wasn't the crime." You know, this is the sort of logic that we have here. But Yudhishthira, of course, I mean, he is the son of Dharma. So he's taking this defense very seriously. It must be okay if I could think it's okay. But then he's getting a little bit more subtle here when he's saying, "The law is subtle, great king, and we do not know its course. We follow one after the other the path that was traveled by the ancient. My voice does not tell a lie," again, even footstep, "nor does my mind go along with us. Thus our mother spoke, and this is my own desire." So he's again referring back to what his mother's words. But I think one of the key things I wanted to emphasize is that subtlety of Dharma, in that there's stuff that happens in this world that we don't really understand, and sometimes we just have to go along with it. That's basically one of the things that he's saying here. Then we get this other explanation, again told by Vyasa, and I have to say that this is one of the most complicated. It's a very short story, but I don't completely understand this story, I must admit. But I'll just sort of summarize it anyway. Is that Drupada, again, is Draupadi's father, and Drupada's the one who is being kind of being persuaded through all of this, because if Drupada is horrified that his daughter's going to marry five men. So a lot of these explanations are actually aimed at Drupada himself. And so Vyasa tells him a story, again, another one involving Shiva. It's interesting now we're on our second explanation that involves Shiva. And in this story, Indra declares himself the king of the gods. But as a punishment for his arrogance and lack of deference, Shiva condemns him and four other Indras. This is the part of the story that I don't really understand. Who are these four other Indras? Where did they come from? Anyway, they're here in this story. Shiva condemns him and the four other Indras to be born as humans with the manifestation of the goddess Shri as their wife. And then at the end of the story, Vyasa grants Drupada the divine eye, and with the divine eye, Drupada then can see the Pandavas as these five Indras and his daughter Draupadi as Shri. So, again, this isn't completely different from, but on the other hand, it's not exactly the same as a karmic explanation or a dharmic explanation. Because here, in a sense, we get this indication that what happens to us in this world has a lot to do with the actions of the gods have amongst each other that we're usually unaware of and have very little control over. That in a sense, our lives are dictated by the actions of the gods in ways that most of us rarely understand. And so, this is why I said the collateral damage of the dramas of the gods and goddesses. And I think that you can find that, for example, a lot of Greek mythology, this theme comes up again and again. I mean, you know, the gods are never presented as perfect individuals. They get more angry and jealous and all sorts of things. It's most humans do most of the time. And when they go to battle with one another, we're the ones who pay for it. So that's another explanation given. And then this one also involves the gods, but we might say there's a difference between fate and destiny. And if the other one is talking more about destiny, the gods kind of made it happen, so then it's going to happen. Fate oftentimes implies that things are sort of going to happen a certain way, but there isn't a sort of controller or an agency kind of dictating how and why they're going to happen that way. It's much more abstract. And so Drupada, for example, says, what has been ordained cannot be undone. So it's already done, can't do anything about it. And this indeed is the ordinate sense. So there's the sense of just, you know, like I just have to live with this. And then Drupada cites the story of the maiden, but then places responsibility on the gods with a hint of doubt remaining when he says, here, the Shankara is Shiva. He says, as Shiva has ordained it so, whether lawful or lawless, I bear no guilt. So in other words, maybe this is not dharmic, but if Shiva said it's okay, well, I guess I'm going to have to live with it. So here we have, maybe I shouldn't have titled this fate. We have both sort of ordination by the gods and fate in his way of understanding it. But we can certainly see that this isn't really resolved here. The people who are involved in this argument are looking, you know, they're searching for all these different possible explanations. It's never agreed upon what really justifies. And then, of course, there's an argument that goes all the way through the Mahabharata that this is just simply was a bad idea in the first place. It was wrong. And that actually this has something to do with why then the Pandavas, but especially Draupadi, end up suffering the fate that they end up suffering. So, for example, Draupadi on several occasions is accused of being a loose woman because she has married five men. Karna explicitly calls her a whore after the dicing match in a scene that we're going to look at this afternoon. And when he does so, he cites the fact specifically that he thinks of her in that way because she's married to five men. And then, of course, one of the major justifications for them going to war is the mistreatment of Draupadi after the dicing scene. So we can also see how this, you know, major incident that throws up all sorts of moral questions, it never goes away. It's part of this chain reaction of events that end up leading to the war. But it's also, as I said, bringing up all these different ways of understanding the world. When something happens to us that we can't quite understand in our lives, you can imagine that we often go through a similar thought process. Well, how can we explain this? Did God ordain this? Do I deserve this? Is this happening because of society? And one of the things that I think is so interesting about this scene is I think it's sort of illustrative of the multiple worldviews in the Mahabharata itself. The Mahabharata doesn't ultimately tell us which is the right explanation. It gives us all of these possible worldviews. And a lot of these worldviews, again, are in play with one another, are bouncing off one another, sometimes in contention with one another in other scenes in the text as well. Okay. Do you know how much time?
10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay. I'm going to try to do this quickly. Okay, now we're going to the scene that I think you're all most familiar with, and a scene that that others will be talking about during the next 3 days, and this is the scene of the Bhagavad Gita. This is one of my favorite pictures of the Bhagavad Gita. I think as others are talking about the Bhagavad Gita, it's visually really nice to keep this in mind, to think of where and the circumstances under which this very important conversation is taking place. Okay, I'm not going to say much about the Bhagavad Gita itself. Other people will talk about the Bhagavad Gita. And again, I just want to preface everything I'm saying by saying this isn't the only way to understand the Bhagavad Gita. But I do think it is one way to understand the Bhagavad Gita. And that is that basically the Bhagavad Gita, one of the things going on is that Arjuna has this moral question. Is it a dilemma? Is it not a dilemma? Again, I'm not sure. I think that's part of the moral question. Does he have a choice not to fight? I don't know. Maybe he does. Maybe he doesn't. But I think that's part of the question that's coming up. And we can see that this is question about whether to fight or not brings up a number of related issues about caste and dharma, family dharma versus caste dharma. Is it his own agency or the will of God? Violence or nonviolence, war or peace, there are possibly others. But with so many of these situations, the moral question doesn't really boil down to just one question usually, but a set of interlinked questions with one another. One thing, though, that is important to remember is that one of the main messages, not the only one, but one of the main messages of the Bhagavad Gita is Krishna's teaching of karma yoga, that basically this idea, it's better to act than not to act. Okay. With that in mind, let's return to this scene in the middle of the war when Arjuna and Krishna are in dialogue with one another. As we saw, Arjuna has this moral dilemma about whether he should keep his vow or not kill his brother. So we explored that part of this scene. But another very interesting thing
is that during this scene, Krishna extols the virtues of nonviolence. He says that it is infinitely better not to destroy life. One can speak false words, but one should never kill in any way at all. This is the same guy who told Arjuna to go and out on the battlefield and fight. Now he's saying this. Again, my argument here, this dialogue is in dialogue with the other dialogue. This is the same two guys, but now we're in a different situation. And what they're saying here, I think, is opening up. It's letting the Mahabharata open up how we might read and understand the Gita. And then he says, fighting and killing cannot be justified in all circumstances. So the way I see this dialogue is it's qualifying Krishna's message in the Bhagavad Gita. Okay, maybe it is to go out and fight that war because of the circumstances that have led up to that war. But that doesn't mean that it's always okay to fight. You can't use my arguments for every circumstance. I see this as a qualification of his earlier message. But if that's a qualification, we might say that this next dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, again, the same two guys, this scene known as the Anugita, is actually a rejection of the earlier teaching. This has a wonderful beginning where this is the last time Arjuna and Krishna talk to each other in the Mahabharata, a scene called the Anugita, which means the after Gita. And this scene kind of reminds me of conversations I have with some of my students during office hours, because Arjuna comes up to Krishna and says, you know that great lecture you gave like right before the battle scene? Well, I forget everything you said. But then Krishna's response, first of all, he's saying, you know, how could you forget that? Weren't you paying attention? So he scolds him for not remembering, but then Krishna says, I don't really remember that either. And then the explanation that he gives is that he had been in a yogic state of mind, and he can't quite channel that state of mind right now. So he's going to give him another teaching instead. I love the fact that there's a bit of humor. I see it that way. It's humor, certainly. In the Mahabharata, I think, offers us that. Yes, we have some of the holiest sections of text in the whole tradition, but it doesn't mean we can't kind of throw light on them in any way. So Arjuna asked to hear the teaching again, and in this teaching, this is one of the most dialogical parts of the whole Mahabharata, that Krishna basically tells him a lot of different dialogues, gives him a different teaching. In one, two warriors are instructed to give up violence and become renouncers, exactly the opposite of what Krishna had told Arjuna during the Bhagavad Gita. In another, Brahma teaches that ahimsa is the greatest dharma, and that violence is the essence of non-dharma. And then, in what Herman Titus suggests is an overt rejection of the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, the god Brahma says that some dull persons praise karma. Who praises karma in the Bhagavad Gita? Krishna does. So we have a real direct criticism about Krishna's earlier teaching. I think that this not only tells us something about dialogue, but it also tells us some really interesting things about
power.
About what?
Power.
But also, I was going to say theology. What's interesting about the theology around Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Mahabharata, is that he's a god that can be questioned. He's a god that can be argued with. In other scenes, he can be told off. He can be cursed. It's not a bad thing to do those things. We have a dialogical understanding of God here, which I think is very interesting. So, I just want to sum up by saying that, focusing on these moral questions, we find they're ultimately unresolved. We, in almost every case, we don't get just two, but we get multiple explanations.
And that these different explanations and these different dialogues are dialogically related to one another. That the Mahabharata gives us all these ways to constantly be reflecting back on itself. Every dialogue picks up on a debate that is already going on. Well, in each case, there are unresolved issues that will be further explored in another dialogue. And then I just want to refer to one of my favorite thinkers today. He's a political scientist who's based in Delhi, named Rajiv Bhargava, who basically argues about something called contextual reasoning. And the point that Bhargava makes is that living in a multicultural, pluralistic society, you can't have some values that always trump, no pun intended, all other values in every situation. That basically, you have to learn how to hold multiple values together, even if sometimes they don't sit easily with one another. I think the Mahabharata is one of the greatest examples of any text anywhere that have tried to do this. Thank you.